Today, Louis, I'd like to talk about housing and dwellings and structures and things like that. Are you ready to talk about that?
You betcha.
Well, let's start at the beginning with housing that housed the Sahuatmec people, the stories that you've been told from your elders. Yeah. Where did the Sahuatmec people live? I know that there was like winter and summer homes. Where did you live and what season?
You know, they moved around quite a bit, but I think all along the Thompson River, South Thompson, it was all along there, right from Kamloops right up to the Narrows and all over the Shuswap Lake. And they spent all the winter there. It was nomadic. And I think I told that before of where the name Shuswap derived from, the Sahuatmec people.
Mm-hmm.
And we done a little research on that, and it kind of came from maybe the Tanakh band called us that, Sahuatmec. Because I think in their language it might mean half-naked people. Because that's the only time they seen us during the summer. A lot of people only seen us during the summer months. And so that's where I think the Sahuatmec came from.
Hmm.
Our people in Salmon Arm here, originally their winter village was over at the Sunnybrae. There's some depressions all along there around that Sky Blue Waters campground.
Oh.
I think they built a bunch of houses over top of them. I'm not too sure. They liked the mostly the western sites. Because it catches the early morning sun, so it heats up the winter homes a lot quicker.
Oh, yeah.
So you see, most of the pit houses are always on the western bank or close to it where the early sunrise can hit it. So that was the reason why they stayed wherever it was. There was very few built on the eastern side where the sunlight doesn't hit it as early. And a lot of our people were, the last ones, I think, were over at Sunnybrae. And my grandmother lived in one when she was a baby in Chase. It was on the eastern bank of the river. She barely remembers because she was just a little baby when just growing up fairly recent. And so she gave us ideas of how to build one. So we relied on her when we first built one. And that was about 60 years ago.
Wow.
Maybe a little bit, 60, maybe 50 some odd years ago. I wrote the story in The Many Faces of Mount Ida of how our people came to where we are now. They were all working for the CP Rail back in the late 1800s when they were coming through here. They were cutting ties and cordwood for the locomotives. That's one of the stories when I talked about, when I asked my mother, where does Naholo come from? And that stumped her. Because a long time ago, we didn't have railway cars.
Is that the word for train?
Yeah, Naholo.
Oh.
And that's where they were working over all along the hillside there, cutting ties and cordwood for the railway.
Hmm.
Then when the Indian agent came in the late 1800s, they said, well, you got to live on reserves. And they already had these all plotted out in Salmon Arm here. So our people moved over to Sandy Point. And they wintered there a few winters. Then it was really, the weather was totally different than it is now. You know, we had tons of ice out in the lake and north winds blowing and blow zero weather all the time, and they were camped all along that beach there, and that cold north wind kept blowing in on them.
Hmm.
So they all moved inland. That's when the pit houses kind of disappeared. So they started building log cabins and any other kind of structures where they wintered. So that's why there's a lot of people, because at one time we were all one nation. That's why you got people from Enderby, Chase, Kamloops, all over. And they settled over here, started building where it is now. Because most of like an hour our Swiss Malt number 3, it's all bottomland, so if you built a pit house, in the springtime you'd have a indoor swimming pool because there's about a foot of water, and we built one there, and it was about a foot of water in the, every spring in the pit houses.
Yeah.
So that's why they went over to building log buildings and different types of buildings. And then when the Indian agent came in, they started supplying lumber. That's when the housing changed.
Mm.
I have another story to tell about that too. I think I mentioned it before when I was doing a talk up at the gathering place. I started talking and all of a sudden I was going to say auditorium. Then I found out, oh, we got no word for auditorium. So I had to do some fast thinking and I come up with Chiyumachit, because that means a big house or big building. And I was doing some fast thinking because, you know, just like Naholoch, you know, you have to come up with some new words.
Yeah.
Like Chitch is a house in our language. Chitch. And Chiyu means big. That brought a little laugh to everybody, you know, because it kind of stumped me too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm just learning the language again. Yeah. And a lot of words start coming back to me. And so it was one of the little quirks of learning the language. I guess it's kind of the fun part, you know. Because sometimes, well, it always is. Housing, that's when our people, like I said, they moved inland and they gave us little reserves. And people started clearing land because they wanted us to become farmers, you know, because we can't go. They didn't want us going out and doing what we did for centuries, you know, hunting and gathering.
Mm-hmm.
And it was part of their way. That way they could probably keep track of us a little better, because I heard stories that we had to have a permit to get off the reserve and go out, and whenever we left it, to keep track of where we were, as part of the government's answer to the Indian problem, they called us, you know, because it was always, we were a problem for them for quite a number of years, and I imagine we still are today.
So the pit houses, you couldn't build the pit houses anymore because the reserves were set out were bottomland. Swiss Malt number 3 was bottomland.
Yeah.
And then, so you started with log buildings and you got lumber, but you mostly used materials at hand.
Right? Yeah.
And so that would have been, the early 1900s to, like, I guess till now, right? Like,
yeah.
Except
yeah.
I know in the 50s, the federal government started a housing policy,
mm-hmm.
which was supposed to support new housing, but did not deal at all with repairs or infrastructure. So there was kind of a cookie cutter box house situation for a few years.
Well, it's not only that. They only gave X amount of dollars, you know, and there was always a part where we had to pay. And at that time, we weren't qualified to work anywhere, because we're still basically hunters and gatherers.
Mm-hmm.
So how can you make a living on that?
Yeah, how do you qualify for a mortgage at a bank?
Yeah. Yeah. So it was built for failure, really.
Mm-hmm. So you still had to buy your house?
Basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the band had to come up with the extra money somehow, and that's where the housing arrears came in.
Mm.
And took a long time, I think, and we're slowly turning it around right now, because we got mortgages now, more reliable mortgages, and there's more policies to cover your new home. I think our arrears and with the government with CMHC is probably close to $1 million yet,
mm-hmm.
that we have to pay back, and so it comes out of general revenue, the shortfall. But I think now that our people are slowly working, Because you remember way back in the 50s, we weren't allowed to graduate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think grade 8 was the highest level you can get. So kind of left its mark, I think, and people didn't understand that. You know, we weren't qualified to become lawyers, teachers, or anything like that. We're better, little better pay.
Mm-hmm.
So it made it difficult for our people to able to pay the mortgage off. So the band had to come up with some general revenue.
Mm-hmm.
And it took a long time to understand about economic development. And now things are a little bit different now. And I think it's going to change. You know, I think it's a way of assimilating us. And maybe it's a future. Who knows?
Well, it would have also been extremely difficult, given that there are racist hiring policies, you know, pretty much widespread. So finding well-paid work consistently enough to be able to qualify for a mortgage through any bank seems like kind of a challenge. So,
And who wanted to hire a stupid Native Indian?
Well, I don't like that. Yeah. I think that one of the biggest...
Well, uneducated.
Yeah, well, you know, and that
basically
the thing is understanding where the barriers were put in place, and then and how why did settlers expect indigenous people to be able to participate in a capitalist system when there all these barriers were in place? Like, it seems it's very unfair, and I think a lot of people don't know about that. That's the
I know. I always people always tell me, oh, we get free money all the time from the government, but I tell them, try living on a reserve for a while.
Yeah.
You'll find out, you know, we have to, the ones that are uneducated have to struggle quite a bit now and rely on the band for assistance.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the welfare system is different, way different than the city. Because in the city, if you're on welfare and you got a room, the government covers up that shortfall, you know, the mortgage part.
Mm-hmm.
They cover that up, whereas on the reserve, they don't. I think our single people only get about $180 a month. It's really difficult to explain the way we were treated. And it took a long time for people to understand that, you know, nothing is free with the government.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're starting to wake up now a little bit and find out that it's totally different.
And then don't you find the cultural aspects of being Sahuatmec were not considered by the government when they had put in place housing policies? Like indigenous people typically had a more communal living situation, right? Your elders lived with you and you had large spaces for families and multiple generations living together. And yet the housing policies kind of forced you into these tiny little boxes that were like supposedly adequate housing. So it didn't take into consideration all of that. Like, did that have an impact on the culture? Like you say, like there's single people living in houses or couples or small families. Like, how does that impact the culture as a whole?
That's always been the problem, you know, that assimilation program or whatever they want to call it. It's kind of eradicating our, like you said, our communal governance, our communal living. Because we don't, we're like everybody else, we don't communicate with each other anymore. You know, it kind of segregated us from each other. Whereas along for centuries, our people had communal governance, communal living, and they all did everything together. We all worked together. And things have changed since then. So it's, I could see it now, you know, when I look back. Now we don't even talk to each other. And I think that's a slowly build up of the anger. The anger was always there for the natives against the government of the treatment that they've gotten. So it's a typical way of getting rid of the native problem, they called us. Because they tried it different ways. You know, I've heard stories about them giving us smallpox blankets to get rid of the native problem. So there's been a lot of instances, and so it's really difficult to understand because I think our governance was totally different, and we were all worked together as a community way back when. But now when I look at it now, you know, it's unexplainable. Yet I think the answer is there, you know, because we've been doing it for centuries, you know, the communal governance.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's more confusing for our people because there's still residues of the old ways in us. Because I remember when my grandmother, I was with my grandmother and grandfather in the old log building, and every spring they built a small, I think it's a little, like a summer cabin out of little trees and whatnot, and they moved in there every summer, spring, because that need to go out into the land was still strong in them. So they moved into that summer building, and they took out all the caulking out of the log building, and they aired out the whole log house.
Hmm.
And because that was the way back when they had the pit houses. They'd take out the women's entrance and take it all apart and air it out the whole winter home.
Hmm.
So I think that was part of the way of our people a long time ago. And it was still, I think, really strong in my grandparents. We got to get out of the winter home.
Yeah.
So they moved into the summer one.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things that after I started learning a little more of the cultures, you know, a lot of things started clicking in. And these are some of the instances, because my grandparents were always happy, seemed like it, and they all looked at each other, supported one another back in the day. But now it's just totally different. You know, we got these little homes that we don't actually own. You know, it still belongs to the government.
Mm-hmm.
But when you think about it, you know, the government has a good system. Because you look at the people that live off the reserve, you know, the community here. Do they actually really own their home? Well, stop paying your taxes.
Yeah, it's true.
You don't die.
Don't
you
make
really.
Your payment one day, right? Or one month, the bank can take it away. So, yeah.
Yeah, so you don't really own your home.
Right.
You know, so it's a government's way of keeping the cash flow coming in, I think.
Yeah, and keeping us from revolting. Because you can't revolt when you don't have a house to live in.
Yeah.
So getting back to sort of the cultural thing, though, I'm wondering if the need for that communal connection, if it kind of manifested in the development of friendship centers. Is that why friendship centers came to be?
Well, friendship centers, I believe, was the people living off reserve in the big towns.
Give them a connection to each other and to their culture?
Yeah, supporting one another.
Mm.
You know, because if you move off the reserve, you're at a loss. You know, who do you go to? Because the Indian Department is there, your chief and council's not there anymore. So who do you go to?
Yeah.
So I think those were open to support one another. And so like my mother, she started the one in Kelowna.
Mm-hmm.
And when she moved there for a few years, and she started talking to people, so they said, well, let's try opening up a little center where we can meet and talk about our problems. So they struggled for quite a number of years, I think 3, 4, 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And they were raising money to open one up. It took a long time for the city to realize that there was a problem there. And they slowly got enough money together. They said they were even collecting empty bottles and fundraising, all kinds of things. And I don't even really remember where they, I think they found a little building, an old building where they moved into and started their friendship center. So And now it's a fairly big thing now in Kelowna.
Yeah.
And she's one of the founding members in there. And so that we don't have one here. And I think I've been talking about it for quite a number of years.
I'm excited by that concept, because you've talked an awful lot about ways to build bridges between settler communities, Indigenous communities, and newcomers, and mm-hmm. that you envision a Friendship Center can do that.
Yeah. Well, I think Friendship Center is always connected to the Native Friendship Centers.
Mm-hmm.
And when I can't remember who I talked to in government that's in charge of Native Friendship Centers, and they said that they're maxed out now.
They're maxed out. That makes me crazy. Can you, like, imagine saying, no, sorry, no more friendship. You can't do that anymore.
Well, it's a Native, you know.
So there, it's the funding thing, right?
Like, yeah.
They won't fund any more friendship centers. So as a nonprofit society, they're saying that that there's a maximum amount of money available for running a place like that?
Yeah, I think that... it's allocated through the government every year,
mm-hmm.
and they have so much money to give out, and if they keep building more and more, how are they going to pay for it? So,
well, I mean, the world keeps expanding, and the population keeps growing, and other agencies like CMHA and, like, you know, all sorts of other agencies, they haven't said to them, oh, the pot is now, like, finite, and you can't start another mental health clinic because there's no more money, right?
Yeah.
Like, if there's a need, then you find the way. That's kind of what governments are supposed to do, but,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we had the same problem with this radio station, too. They set it up. Is it kind of like for failure? Because they don't give any money to keep it going.
Yeah.
You know, so... it's a good idea. Everybody, all of a sudden, they hit a good idea, but they forget about where's the money coming from, because it's the same thing. You got to keep fundraising to keep this place going.
Yeah.
And nobody thinks about that.
Yeah, things just exist, and people use the services and not really think about that somebody's scrambling for money all the time.
Because in my talks with the friendship societies or the friendship people, they said that our best bet would be to go to a society, non-profit society,
mm-hmm.
not a Native Friendship Center. Because I think they're finding that all the people that live in the communities, they all have the same problem. You know, who do I go to? Where do I go? Mm-hmm. Who do I talk to?
So it's a resource and referral kind of place too, right? It's not just a place to have coffee and meet up and talk, but actually find access to services.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
And give support wherever, you know, like, I think they're finding out that everybody has the same problem. So it's a place where everybody can go now as a community, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think most bands or most friendship centers are openers to non-Indigenous people too.
Because
mm-hmm. that's what they told me was that they're competing with the bands for Aboriginal funding. But if we went to a society, all the funding is all to all levels of government.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas only the friendship centers are only eligible basically for federal money.
Right.
But I think they're accessing some provincial now. But, you know, but to me, a friendship center is about meeting one another and communicating with each other.
Well, you know, I have a story about a friendship center. When I lived in Grand Prairie, on my way home from work, I had to cross the tracks and go down this long street that was mm-hmm. wide open to the world. And of course, it was like minus 45 in the wintertime, so the wind was howling and stuff. And there was a friendship center right across the tracks. And so I would stop in there to warm up before I kept going home. Mm-hmm. And I just remember two things about that place. First of all, that there was this little area where I would see lots of Indigenous folks just sitting having coffee, which was amazing. And then there was a little tiny gift shop. And every once in a while, I would buy something from the gift shop because I felt like I needed to kind of pay for the space I was using up when I was getting warm. And yeah, I bought like cute little moccasins one time, and I bought earrings one time, right? Mm-hmm. So it was like I thought that was a thing that can generate revenue and help, mm-hmm. You know, bring those kind of cultural creations to the community is mm-hmm. In a place like that, right? Where you know that yeah. you're buying directly from the makers mm-hmm. and not from, you know, China. So that was a really neat experience that, and it was always open and welcoming. People always were greeting the people that came in, no matter what background you were. It was yeah. very welcoming.
I think I'd remember too, most of our cultures are about sharing, you know, and our people, you know, they're kind of at the bottom of the so-called totem pole. they're willing to share their friendship at least. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a big plus for our people. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't see too many Native radicals around, not anymore, but you know, it's that, because I'm always seemed like I'm on call sometimes too. I think about 3-4 times I had to go up to the hospital, and my name seems to be bandied around there quite a bit. So they're the first person to call me to go up to the hospital and talk to whoever's hurting or in need of help. So I'm kind of doing the referrals.
Yeah,
I don't mind it, you know, because it's helping people out. Because when I was growing up, I was kind of at a loss. And I didn't know, maybe it's my stubborn pride, I didn't ask for help. I just had to figure out the way things, but I wished I did have help, you know. Maybe I would have grew up the way I grew up different than when I was younger, you know.
As a resource and referral person, you can see a need for someone like that if you get these calls, like mm-hmm. from places like the hospital where people need services. So the Friendship Center kind of idea could also help with that.
Yeah, most definitely, you know. And you find a lot of the people that are, you know, you look at the homeless people around here. Who do they go to? And that would be the same with our people moving off the reserve that owe tons of money on their homes. They won't give them a new home, or they won't give them, you know, support. So naturally, they have to move into the city because the city can afford to pay their rent.
Right. So they have to move off reserve and into the cities and to get a job so that they can pay their rent, but yeah. also pay their mortgage that they have on their house back on reserve.
No, they don't pay for that.
So how does
But they when they get a room, they get X amount of dollars for they have to put. Part of it goes into, I think that's the way it goes. I think they have enough money in the affordable housing. They have enough money to pay for the portion of the main portion of the mortgage. Then the other part that's still owing the government kicks that in. You know, so they get the full mortgage paid off. And they could still live on welfare. And I don't know how much money they get while they're in there. For living, it's kind of like a living allowance. So they don't really have to pay anything. Whereas on a reserve, if you don't pay off the rest of your mortgage, you end up owing. And alcoholism, drugs gets in their way, and they get farther and farther behind, and they can't pay for their mortgage anymore. So they're basically homeless. So they move into the city and they're stuck. Yeah, who do I go to? So 99 times is their Friendship Center, that's the place they go to get the support they need, and they help them out. So I think Friendship Centers really help out the natives when they're moving off the reserve. And but they still have their problems, you know, and like I said, if they have problems moving off the reserve, they bring their problems to the cities wherever they move. So,
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, like the reasons why people move off reserve. Like housing is definitely one of the reasons. Yeah. Insecure housing, substandard housing, yeah, that has been, you know, through federal policies over decades, without proper infrastructure, and then not big enough for families and things like that. So housing is definitely a big reason. What are some other reasons that people move off reserve and into cities?
Job wise, there might be more employment in a bigger city if they're really looking for employment to kind of get the, you know, a little move in the right direction. Because opportunities on reserve are limited. Employability. If you look around town here, how many of our people are working in banks? How many of our people are working in, you know, high executive spots? I can't think of one instance.
Yeah.
And even the city doesn't hire our people. You know, none of our people are working for the city. Yeah. And that's a level of government that we're supposed to be working with.
Yeah.
And so it's employability. And I think that's another one our people are kind of struggling with yet. But the education level of our people now are going up and up and up. So there is employment available, but not at the local level. Hmm. And so they have to move maybe where there's better chance of them going up the ladder.
I have noticed that when there's been somebody who's been doing some incredible work with, you know, youth services or healthcare or whatever, they seem to get hired by big places in like Vancouver, Victoria, and then they have to move.
Well, I think the bands are doing a better job of it now, especially the ones that can afford it now. They're hiring more and more native people that have the qualifications now. Mm-hmm. I have two daughters that are working, one was working for the other Squamish band, and one is working for the Songhees band right now. So it's opportunities out there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's where the money is. And it's kind of a tough world we live in yet.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely tough for a lot of people. But but this is, you know, historically, we've done some pretty horrible things to the Indigenous population. So kind of feels like a time when we can make some reparations. But housing doesn't seem to be one of them. Like, housing doesn't seem to be doing well. And especially because there's, like I said, there's so much more cultural knowledge about how Indigenous groups lived and the kinds of housing that they would normally have, you know, like that were culturally supportive, and still nobody's making any effort to kind of address that.
Yeah, well, that's a good question for me too. I always wonder about that. How do you get that communal feeling back together again like it was for centuries?
Mm-hmm.
And
that could be like a housing priority right now, but yeah. I don't know. I haven't heard anything about that.
You look at the cultural aspect, because the way current society is running, it seems like we're getting farther and farther away from that communal living.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's something that big chiefs can think about, you know, start looking at different ways of our living conditions on reserve, to bring back that communal spirit, because everything the government does, it's got to be their way. But nobody really looks at our current conditions and how does that fit in, our culture fits in with the way, the modern way, so-called modern way of living.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the nuclear family unit.
Yeah, isolation, live in isolation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's very much about that. And a lot of people have theories about why that, you know, that works for capitalism, because all of a sudden you need a whole separate household that needs a dishwasher and a, you know, and mm-hmm. a microwave and all the things, right? And so it makes you buy more stuff when you have everybody living in individual homes.
Yeah, and buying more stuff. That brings back something that we talked about years ago. You know, our people took pride in making what they did, the baskets, everything. They were built for basically your lifetime. But now the way everything is built, it's all disposable. You know, nobody takes pride in their workmanship anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You look at the things that you buy now, you buy a lawnmower, you buy a fridge, you buy a washing machine. How long do they last?
Yeah.
You know, it's how do they make a buck?
Mm-hmm. They want you to keep buying it every 5 years or less.
That's yeah. for sure.
Yeah.
You know, because if you made a basket, that's got to last you pretty well your lifetime. And you take pride in your work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what our people did a long time ago. You know, that whatever they made, it was built to last a lifetime.
So getting back to housing, that was a concept for housing too, right? Because housing was portable.
Mm-hmm.
As a nomadic people, yeah. you had to pick your materials carefully,
mm-hmm.
with durability, so that you could pick things up and move them and build it again.
Yeah. Well, that was the summer homes, but the winter homes, you know, a lot of people are asking me, how did your people cut it without a power saw? You know, the big logs for the support beams?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I didn't think about it at first. Then we asked my grandmother, oh, you stupid Indians. She said, they just buried the part they wanted to keep and they burnt off the rest.
Oh.
Simple as that.
Huh.
You know, and then they used a little stone adze and chipped it out and squared it off. So, you know.
That's interesting.
Because, you know, we don't think about things like that now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a problem long time ago and our people figured it out.
Yep.
So.
Using what's at hand.
Yeah. And a lot of people, you know, the frills on the jacket, you know, it looks pretty classy. But people don't realize it was there for a purpose too. You know, when you're out way out, you're miles away from your home, and your moccasin breaks down or some other part, or you need something to tie something up real quick, all you do is cut off one of the fringes and use it to sew your moccasin, or use it to tie up something you need pretty bad. And so
wow.
It wasn't just a decoration, but
yeah.
You know.
It's like a kit. You had a kit with you
yeah.
all the time. That's great.
Yeah.
That's brilliant.
So, yeah, these are things that we never think about, you know. And because, you know, we've been doing it a certain way, because I didn't think about power saws, you know, because we didn't have back in the day even a crosscut saw. Or,
mm-hmm.
But how did our people manage it?
Yeah, well, in the pit houses were, like, the support beams are large.
Yeah.
So there would be one in the center, right?
Yeah.
And then all the ones that came out from the edge of the circle into the center.
Yeah.
Like that, those are very large logs.
Mm-hmm. Because you needed some pretty heavy wood to withstand, especially in the wintertime when we had about 3-4 feet of snow.
Yeah.
So it was a lot of weight involved in what we're doing, but...
And then, so what was holding up the roof between those big beams, those big logs?
Well, they had side beams going around it.
Oh, okay.
At intervals.
And how would those be connected to the big ones?
Well, they'd be tied right into the main logs. You know, it's like a pyramid. Because that's one thing, our people always did things in circles. My mother talked about it quite a bit, you know, because... The early settlers, you know, they think triangular or square, thinking in square.
Mm-hmm.
But our people thought in circles. So how do you get the two people together? How do you put a circle into a square? It's pretty difficult.
Yeah.
Because our way of thinking was totally different than the Europeans, you know, so... These are some of the things, okay, now, that's where this talk of reconciliation, because we're trying to fit a circle into a square. And you talk about reconciliation. That's going to be one of the problems that has to be dealt with. So it's kits all, you know, and it's I've been, me and my mother's been doing this reconciliation for quite a number of years now, I think about 50 years now, and still people kind of are still not quite there yet, you know, because I find they're still, I think we're kind of handicapped yet, because like I only have a grade 12 level, and I never really, I think my role in my lifetime was looking after my people in the local area here. I was asked to run for chief a few times, but I didn't really want that responsibility. I felt my responsibility was with my people here in Salmon Arm. And besides, anybody ever see a skinny chief? Joke. But no, I spent my lifetime, because that's where I started working with all people. Because when I first got on council, I didn't know anything. I just knew life on the res, my in and out of trouble. I had more connections with people outside the law. And so my education community-wise wasn't all that great. And I got on council, I asked my people, well, what am I supposed to do? Oh, you're supposed to go to these big meetings, Vancouver, Prince George, or Kamloops, or, you know. I gave you a nice, expensive room, and got TV, you got everything, you got three square meals a day, and you go to these big meetings carrying your little briefcase, looking important, like me, I'm going in there, look, I'm a counselor from Salmon Arm. I think I went about 3 months going to those fancy meetings, and I realized, you know what, I'm not having any input. I don't even know a bloody thing. So I came back and sat in my, we had a little A-frame in my office was upstairs, and I sat there for about 2-3 weeks. And, you know, what did I want when I was just a band member? I said employability. So I looked around, and my views on economic development was pretty limited. So I figured, well, I'll go to my neighbors in town here and introduce myself and see what's going on. Because, you know, there's limited, so because our economic development is limited because it's all the development around us, so it kind of limits us into how we develop our economic development. Introduced myself to the city, you know, because I wanted to learn. So I basically used that as my college. I joined every committee I could think of to get a better understanding of, because I figured a good leader should know a little bit about everything. So I sat on the environmental committee, I sat on the social planning committee, I sat on the college advisory board, I sat on community futures. Then they talked me into becoming part of the new health system they got now. I was on the interim board for that one. And I think they called it New Directions at the time. So I learned a little bit about health there, and I sat on every group I could think of to get a really understanding about how a community, modern so-called community, operated on.
Well, you basically have a master's now in community engagement and social development. That's a master's program that exists. And that's what you are walking around with the knowledge of right now, because you did that.
Yeah, but to me, it was about the friendship I created along the way. Because I guess maybe that's why everybody keeps coming to me, you know, to join their organization. But they forget, too, you know what, if I was to join every organization that I was asked, I wouldn't have any time for myself.
Exactly.
I'd be busy 8 days
You'd
a week.
You'd be in meetings. Yes, exactly. You'd be in meetings from dusk till dawn.
Yeah, but so, it's, you know, that's part of my life, you know. And I think it's getting that understanding, too, of how do we coexist. You know, and I think it's slowly coming, but I don't know if it's the community is ready for us yet, and or are we ready for the community, the Rez people. But, you know, remember when I gave a talk about truth and reconciliation, it could never happen unless you get to know each other first. And that's the first big step towards reconciliation. Because I think we're still kind of segregated, you know. People don't understand. That's why they say, oh, we're getting all kinds of money from the government, which is never the case. We just barely have enough to keep our bands going.
Mm-hmm.
It's just into the infrastructure, that's all.
Yeah.
And the money is very limited that comes out to the community itself. So it's been a long road to hoe, but things are getting a little better, seems like it. But like I said, it's our education level of our people. You know, how do we run our reserves? They're looking now into economic development. Because I think our way of life is gone. But I said everything is disappearing. All our salmon are gone. All our plants are disappearing. All our trees are gone. Our way of life is pretty well gone. That's why I keep reminding people, you know, it's that truth and reconciliation. They talk about it to us. But how about to the first ones that were here? The plants, the animals, the fish, everything. They've been here since time immemorial. And we've taken and taken from the land. And I think maybe the land is fighting back now. Like I say, there are Kwisatz, you know, there are relatives. And they're getting mad. And I could see it. Because every time you take something, you have to give back in return, according to our old culture. Kind of say, you know, it's like putting money in a bank. You don't put any back in there, you keep using your card, until it's all gone. The way our way of life, you know, we keep taking from the land. You know, you look at all the trees we've extracted, all the minerals, everything we've extracted. It's all gone. But how do we give back truth and reconciliation to the land? And how do we give back what we've taken? So that's one of the biggest questions I think that I always think about.
Well, speaking of questions, the question of the day has to do with a structure that Sahuatmec people built in order to smoke salmon. Now, we were really fortunate in the exhibition at the art gallery a few years ago, Skelton, that was about salmon, that you and your brother Jerry and your nephew and like you gathered materials and you built a smokehouse inside the art gallery. That was amazing.
Yeah.
It was beautiful. Can you tell us a little bit about building that structure? How did you learn to do that?
Well, years ago when I was salmon fishing and I was catching about 200 fish every night. And we didn't have deep freezes back in the day. So I asked my grandmother to help me learn how to smoke salmon and the structure for it. So she taught me ever since then. Because, you know, we're not like the Fraser people. You know, they use the heat and rocks and everything to just dry their fish.
Mm-hmm.
Our weather here is too damp. So we had to dry them a different way, so smoking was the only way. So we used the material on hand and built that one.
So which was? What did you use?
Mostly bulrushes for the wall and light poles all around the square structure. And you hung up the salmon up on top there, and then you built a fire underneath and smoked it.
So the like small trees would be used for poles, and yeah. You build a roof and walls and everything. Mm-hmm. And then bulrushes would be...
the walls.
So you would just...
draped over and tied in.
Right, bending them over the posts.
Yeah.
And, yeah. So it would be all enclosed? Like, would it be all... Oh, okay.
Yeah, and you left a little opening there for the door to get in and out, to bring in the salmon, bring it out.
Yeah.
And
how long would this take to
Well, it took me quite a while because we're building this on cement floor. So we had a little problem there, and so we figured it out and we built it. And actually, when we had to take it out of there, it actually fit right on. Did we wreck that one?
That one you had to take apart, but I know you built another one.
Yeah.
For...
Oh, on the parade.
Right, for the parade.
Yeah, and that's the one that fit right on the back of the pickup.
That's handy.
Because it was just the right size, and they wanted it over at Squilex at their salmon days over there. So we put it on the back of the pickup, and we're driving down the highway there, and the bulrushes kept flying off. And we stopped at Tapanesso and got some gas, and we decided, oh, we'll go through Skamekin, where we can go slower. So we stopped every so often and checked the bulrushes to see if they're still on and everything, and... Every time we stopped, somebody would stop there and ask us, what are you guys hauling? I looked at it, you know, and I said, oh, it's an Indian camper. That got everybody laughed because it looked like a camper on the back because it fit just perfectly. And, but, you know, it's putting a little Suwakmuk humor to it. Yeah. And,
that's so funny.
But you know what, we ran into the same problem because I built one for the Kelowna Museum, a pit house over there, and we're building it on a cement floor. That lasted for quite a while, and what we did is they were inventive, and we had they put a huge mirror, and we built half of one.
Oh.
And they had a huge mirror in the back, so when you looked in, you couldn't go inside, but you look in, it looked like a complete one. And so that lasted at the Kelowna Museum for quite a number of years. We were trying to figure out how to put the sod up on top. So museum got some, what do you call it, turf?
Oh, yeah, AstroTurf.
They put that on top, I guess. Putting that turf on there, all of a sudden the snake started going out, so they had to get rid of that in a hurry.
Oh, you mean it was real turf? Like,
yeah.
Oh, like real grass. Okay, I thought you meant like the plastic grass.
Yeah, the sod. That was the sodding. That's one of the weirdest things. Yeah, it was, they've been there quite a number of years, and they finally took it out and got the Okanagans to build one in there, because I was in Okanagan territory when I built that one.
Oh.
So they got a... Okanagan to build that one.
Yeah. Louis, this has been another enlightening episode. Thank you very much for sharing your knowledge and your stories. And yeah, we really enjoyed learning more about housing and dwellings and structures. Yeah. So thank you, Cook's Gem.
We'll see you.
We'll see you next time.